This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Nosebleeds are usually not dangerous, but because they can occur quite suddenly and with what can seem like quarts of blood gushing from your nose, they can be quite scary. Well, here with more on the proper and most effective treatments for this very common problem is Dr. Jennifer Vilwack. She's a senior resident in the Department of Otolaryngology and Communication Sciences at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Vilwack. Thanks for coming in.
Yep, thanks for having me.
So help us understand first, when we say nosebleeds, they're also medically known, I guess, as epistaxis. What exactly is happening?
Yeah, so essentially, you know, it's a very common problem, as you did mention. And essentially what's happening is there's bleeding from one of the multiple vessels that are in the nose. The nose has one of the most extensive, you know, vascular networks in the body. So essentially any of those very little tiny vessels to larger vessels could suddenly start bleeding. And there's a variety of different reasons why that might happen.
And is it important where in the nose that occurs? I mean, in terms of the severity of the problem? In other words, if it happens in the front, is it less severe than if it happens in the back?
Yep, absolutely. So the most common nosebleeds are starting in the front or anterior in the nose. And those are by far the majority of nosebleeds. Those tend to be less severe, and a lot of times they'll respond to just if you hold your nose tightly and apply some pressure. There's a subset of nosebleeds that are further back in the nose, and those tend to be more severe. They tend to be from larger vessels, and as you can imagine, they're a little bit harder to get to. You can't really apply pressure in the back of your nose as you can for those little bleeders in the front.
How common are they, and when, you know, what percentage, for example, might require some help?
Mm-hmm. So nosebleeds are pretty common. Overall, in the literature, they say that approximately 60% of the U.S. population will experience a nosebleed of some sort. But I think almost virtually everybody has experienced, you know, a couple of drops of blood from the nose, whether it's, you know, after getting hit in the face or blowing your nose too much after a cold or a respiratory tract infection. Of those 60% that have, you know, more significant nosebleeds that they're reporting to their physicians, about 6% of those will actually go on to require more intervention and need to present to a medical professional.
We're going to get to talking about how you know the difference, but what I'm curious about now is what are the causes generally when mm-hmm. you look at, you know, I mean, you mentioned getting hit in the nose. I mean, that's quite obvious, but what are some of the other causes that lead to nosebleeds in people?
Well, certainly at this time of year when, you know, the heater is running because it's cold outside, that cold, dry air and then also the warm, dry air when you make your transition from outside to inside is very drying on the nose. And a lot of those vessels that I mentioned can be very superficial. And so just that extra drying can cause some irritation of the mucosa or the lining over top of those vessels. And once that erodes through or gets irritated, you can have bleeding there.
So does it require some trauma, like, I hate to be so overt about it, but picking your nose, for example, does it require some physical trauma to actually make it bleed, or can it just spontaneously start to bleed?
It can just spontaneously start bleeding, and I suspect a lot of that is because, you know, you might not be aware of the minor trauma that might have caused the nosebleed. For example, if you're just rubbing your nose or if you're blowing your nose quite frequently, it doesn't seem like that's obvious trauma to you, but, you know, to those delicate tissues on the inside of the nose, it can be enough to start a nosebleed. And certainly things like manipulation in the nose, whether it's, you know, with your finger picking your nose, or, you know, folks that have to wear a nasal cannula for oxygen delivery at home, those things can be very irritating to the nose as well.
Right. Who's most at risk for this? I mean, do we see it across the population, or are there certain age groups that are more or less at risk?
Yeah. There's a certain group of children that just for, you know, unknown reasons do have a lot of issues with nose bleeding. They tend to outgrow that as they get older. In the population that we see presenting to the hospital, I would say the most salient risk factor is anticoagulation, so folks that are on medications to thin the blood. So examples of that would be aspirin, warfarin or Coumadin, Plavix, and then even herbal or alternative remedies such as fish oil also have a blood thinning effect, so that can kind of predispose you to have a nosebleed, because once it starts, your blood's not going to be as apt to clot, so you can have a longer or more severe nosebleed from those things.
How about just generally having colds or allergies? In other words, people who may be more allergic, are they generally more susceptible to something like a nosebleed?
Yeah, they're also more susceptible just because there's more constant irritation to that mucosa or that covering over the blood vessels. And there tends to be, again, more manipulation of that area as you're blowing your nose or trying other things to help with whatever congestion or other symptoms you're having.
Are there any anatomical things that lead to it? I mean, I remember as a kid people saying, well, he has a deviated septum kind of thing, either because they were born that way or they had an injury in soccer or something of that nature. I mean, are there anatomical things that also make you more apt to experience nosebleeds?
Yep, absolutely. And as you mentioned, septal deviations are one thing that make you more apt. And I, you know, the main theory behind why that is just there's more turbulent airflow. So again, more likely to have kind of trauma from the airflow.
Oh, I see.
And there's also septal perforations, or a hole in the septum, also predisposes you to have nosebleeds as well. And a lot of times we'll see people in the emergency room who have a nosebleed, and we'll comment, you know, we see that there's a hole in your septum, and that might be the first time that they're even noting that they have a hole there, is because they have the epistaxis or the nosebleed, which leads them to get medical intervention.
How about things like smoking or being exposed to smoke, either secondhand or yourself? Mm-hmm. Does that raise the incidence?
Yep. Also? And again, it just goes back to anything that's going to be irritating for the nasal mucosa is going to put you more at risk to have a nosebleed. And certainly there's a host of things in cigarette smoke and secondhand smoke that are going to irritate that area.
So in general, they're not serious.
Correct.
And they're quite common, as you've said, mm-hmm. and we've both talked about. But can they ever be more serious?
Yes. So as we mentioned earlier, there's kind of the nosebleeds that start more in the front of the nose, which generally, if you spray some Afrin or nasal decongestant that help constrict the blood vessels and hold pressure, those will stop. But the nosebleeds that are more posterior are more of a problem, A, because it's harder to see them and apply the pressure that might help them to stop, and B, because they can be from larger vessels in that area that just you're not going to be able to stop with things like pressure.
Do they also occur because of some a more serious underlying problem at that point?
Not always. You know, there's a subset of patients that have scary things that are causing their nosebleeds, such as tumors, you know, further back in the nose, and those can bleed quite briskly. But for a lot of people, it's what we call idiopathic. We just don't really have a clear reason as to why that would start. And, you know, again, if they have other medical conditions, you know, making them be on blood thinners or uncontrolled high blood pressure, those things can kind of facilitate the nosebleed. But for a lot of patients, we just don't have a great explanation of why it starts.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with Dr. Jennifer Vilwalk, and we're talking about nosebleeds, why they occur, and how best to treat them. Can they ever be life-threatening, I guess, is the question. Let's say you're on a blood thinner. If you can't stop the bleeding, mm-hmm. can it ever be life-threatening?
Yes, they certainly can be life-threatening bleeding levels. And so the way that you would kind of tell is, you know, if it's to the point where you're holding your nose in the front and it's bleeding through your mouth, you know, quite briskly.
Down the back of your throat,
yeah, because the back of your nose and your throat are connected, then that's kind of an indicator that it's getting to be very serious. And for some folks, it's almost as if you've turned a faucet on, you know, and it's just there's nothing that you can do to stop the flow of the blood.
So I want to talk a little bit more about what kind of medical intervention and how to get them. But let's just generally say, in the most general, common garden variety nosebleed, what should you do?
So the first thing to do is just to hold pressure. And some people like to use things like clothespins or other things just to make it easier for themselves. My recommendation would just be to use, you know, your thumb and your index finger and hold pressure in the front of the nose, kind of pinching off the nostrils. And to do that for about 15 to 20 minutes. So not
that long.
Yeah, so not just a couple of minutes. I mean, just really crank down on that area for 15 minutes or so. If you have things on hand at home like oxymetazoline, the trade name for that is Afrin. It's available over the counter. That spray is a topical decongestant and a vasoconstrictor, so it'll help kind of shrink the vessels that are bleeding, and that can also be very helpful in stopping the nosebleed.
Should you ever do what I remember seeing people do when I was young, basically stuff the nose with tissue paper or, you know, toilet paper or something, you know, like that to try to block it up? Is that a wise thing to do or not?
I wouldn't necessarily recommend that. A, because you're initiating more trauma into that area just by inserting the tissues, and B, you know, the tissue is there to help absorb the blood, but also, you know, hopefully maybe blocking off what's bleeding. But ultimately, just that little bit of pressure from the tissue isn't going to work as well as if you're holding pressure with your fingers.
How about head position? I mean, I've heard things like keep your head back, keep your head forward. What's the right head position?
Yeah, in general, we recommend that you keep your head in a very neutral position. The reason being, if you're tilting your head forward, then now you have gravity kind of helping the blood to keep coming out. And if you tilt your head back, again, as we mentioned, the back of the nose and the throat is connected, and there's actually quite a bit of space back there. So if your head is tilted back, the blood's going to start pooling, you know, if it's still bleeding in the back of the nose, you can get big clots that then are problematic, and that you'll have blood kind of running down the back of your throat, which becomes a little bit more distressing for the person who's having the nosebleed as well.
How about things like ice?
Ice is also a good option. You know, certainly you wouldn't put the ice inside the nose, but you can, you know, put ice kind of over the nasal bridge or the top of the nose. And again, it works in a similar way as the decongestant, you know, just
as the Afrin to help constrict the blood vessels. So the basic point is you're trying to help the blood stop by constriction of the blood vessels and then the natural clotting.
Correct.
That would take place, but you have to help it along mechanically in some way or chemically or in the case of temperature.
Right, absolutely.
So when and how do you know, I mean, this may seem self-evident, but when and how do you know that this is more serious and you're going to need some help?
Mm-hmm. So one way is, you know, if you're having just a lot of bleeding. You know, you're holding pressure, your head's in a neutral position, and the blood is just still coming. It's coming out your mouth. You know, you're just having bleeding above and beyond, you know, what any person would think is normal. If you're holding pressure for that 15 to 20 minutes, and as soon as you release, it starts bleeding again, that would also be an indicator that you should come in and get some help, because it's unlikely to stop on its own at that point in time.
So what would you then recommend? I mean, people should go to an emergency department?
Mm-hmm. Yep, you can certainly either go to an urgent care or an emergency department, and at that point, they'll be able to try additional things. For those bleeds that happen in the very front of the nose, sometimes we can see the prominent blood vessels that are actually bleeding, and at that point, we can apply cautery directly to that area.
Just heat to actually seal it off.
Yeah, usually what we initially do will be chemical cautery with a silver nitrate stick. So it works similar to the heat cautery, same kind of principle. Is using either heat or chemicals to shrink those blood vessels down so they stop bleeding.
What other types of techniques might you need to use?
So usually when we have a patient that we see in our emergency department here at Upstate, we will do a nasal endoscopy, meaning we'll look into the nose with a little camera. That way we can better see and visualize the site of bleeding. Again, if it's very small and not bleeding too briskly, we can use that silver nitrate. There's other special chemicals that you can use. One is thrombin that's kind of on a foam matrix. And so the thrombin is essentially a chemical in the blood that helps things clot. So we can apply that directly to the area that's bleeding.
You did some research where you looked at, I guess, a certain number of cases and the types of intervention that were done with regard to nosebleeds. What'd you find?
Yeah, so essentially we found that, you know, the vast majority of folks are either being treated conservatively, meaning sprays with the Afrin, you know, holding pressure, that there's another subset of folks that are actually going to the operating room or going to the interventional radiology suite to either have ligation or clipping or cutting of the arteries that are bleeding or having, you know, a different substance infused.
That's a much smaller number.
Yeah, that's a much smaller number.
And what was the bottom line? Was it that early treatment really solved the problem?
Yeah, so in the people that have nosebleeds severe enough to warrant admission to the hospital, early treatment within the first 24 hours, you know, helps in terms of the overall length of stay and cost associated with that hospitalization, just because if you have such a severe nosebleed, it's unlikely to stop on its own.
So what's the bottom line for parents or anyone listening if they have a kid who children do tend to grow out of this.
Mm-hmm.
But what's the bottom line?
So the bottom line is, you know, if it's a severe nosebleed, it's not getting under control in 15 to 20 minutes, I would go to your local emergency department. Things that you can try at home are things like just holding pressure. If you have that oxymetazoline or Afrin nasal spray that you can apply, ice to the bridge of the nose, all of those things are very helpful. But ultimately, if it's a very severe nosebleed or if it's a nosebleed that's occurring, you know, every couple of days, you know, it gets under control, but it's a persistent problem. At that point, you don't have to go to the emergency room necessarily, but I would seek additional care to see if, you know, there's a little vessel that we could cauterize or if further treatment is needed so it's not an ongoing problem.
Well, that's very wonderful and helpful advice. Thanks very much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Jennifer Vilwalk. She's a senior resident in the Department of Otolaryngology and Communication Sciences at Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.